Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong, and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am the managing editor of Dread Central. I am also a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. This week, we are talking about one of my favorite horror movies of all time, 1995's horror anthology, Tales from the Hood. Not only are we talking about one of the best horror anthologies ever, we are joined today by the creator, writer, and director himself, Sir Rusty Cundiff. I just feel beyond lucky for the chance to be joined by this director who has an amazing career working with people like Dave Chappelle, Wanda Sykes, Morgan Freeman, and Spike Lee. Together, we're going to discuss his original vision for more Tales from the Hood's films, some sort of franchise that he had in mind, as well as an unrealized television show, which would have been awesome. We were lucky to get two sequels in the Tales from the Hood franchise, but that they're not exactly what Rusty had in mind. For anyone who needs a refresher, Tales from the Hood was a 1995 horror anthology movie. Each segment, there were four of them, represented a different concept that the writer-director believed affected the African-American community in the United States in the 90s. And so they, in order, were police corruption, domestic abuse, racism, and gang violence. Now, these stories, like any good anthology film, were wrapped together with just the wildest wraparound story ever, and maybe in some ways it was the standout of the film, where you're seeing three drug dealers approach this really eccentric funeral home with a very bizarre funeral director, and I guess they just have a lesson to learn. This movie was scary, it's funny, it's thoughtful, and it's really sad, it's tragic. I have to say, it's definitely a must-watch for horror fans, so if you haven't had a chance to check this one out, you've got to. I'm about to pick Rusty's brains about, you know, these unrealized projects, but also about this really cool-sounding sci-fi epic that he just made, starring Morgan Freeman and Josh Hutcherson. Enjoy my interview with director Rusty Cundiff. Your very well known to horror fans for the Tales from the Hood films. How often do fans approach you about those films? How often does that sort of come up in your life?
Probably more than I would have thought when we made the movie years ago. God, I don't like to think how long ago it was, because it only reminds me of how old I am. But you make things in a bubble of the period and the time that you're in, and you're just focused on everything about it at that moment. And to be years down the road and have, you know, I've done so many talks at different schools about it. A few places have kind of taught it in, you know, a small way as part of a curriculum, not the whole curriculum. And to have so many, I think one of the reasons why, especially in the first Tales, the one that everyone really loves, the stories sadly somehow all seem to be still pertinent. It's like we're living so much of these things over and over again. So in one way, it's, you know, it's gratifying that people still have a connection to it and new people find it. And then at the other, on the other hand, it's, you know, it's kind of frustrating that you're still dealing with the same ills in society. But it, I guess in a sense that makes, that's understandable, because, you know, the whole idea behind Tales anyhow was that, you know, we are the monsters, humanity, we're our own monster. There's, you know, the paranormal is not really what we have to be afraid of. We really have to be afraid of the people walking up and down the street. That's who is going to come and get us. And so the idea that, you know, people are people from hundreds and hundreds of years ago till today, you know, we still haven't grown out of some of the, of what we are, which is basically at some level killing machines.
Yeah. And maybe in some ways it's gotten better, but in some ways it's maybe gotten worse. How has audience response to the film changed over the last, you know, 30 years?
Well, that's really interesting, because, you know, I would say when we first came out, for instance, when the film first opened, there was a commonality of opinion amongst groups as it related to some of the stories, because it's anthology within Tales. Mm-hmm. And then there was a divergent opinion about some of the stories. So the story about the rogue cops that was the one that opens up the film. I had a lot of white audiences at the time that really did not like that story, but they really liked the story at the end, which was Lamont Bentley's gang character and Rosalind Cash, who's trying to save him. In that was kind of the black on black crime story. The front part was the blue on black crime story. Today, there are, you know, young members of the African American community that I talk to that don't particularly like the gang story, because they feel like I'm not understanding Crazy K enough, because he's had all these problems heaped upon him. I don't agree with that, but that and I wouldn't say that is a large majority, but there is that sentiment that wasn't there when we made the movie. On the other hand, a lot more of the white audience now really appreciates the cop story. So, you know, I guess as with all things in society, because the film is dealing with ills that we have every day, it's kind of a fluid understanding that people is formed by the audience, that kind of changes as we change, as we learn about ourselves and have different approaches to the things that we're dealing with on a day to day.
It's definitely one of my favorite horror films, and I've been really fascinated with the journey you were on to get the follow-up titles made. And I think you've been on record saying that the success of Get Out helped with, you know, interest in getting it funded. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we had a chance to get a sequel made maybe just a year or so after the first one. And then, you know, as often happens, studio heads changed and on and on, and we could never get it off the ground, which is kind of too bad, because that one we would have had at least the budget, if not more, than we had for the first one. And from talking to people, like, that budget today, which was a little over $6 million then, would probably be somewhere between 18 and 20 today. So we didn't get it made, and Get Out comes along and does, you know, amazingly well, and really reignites interest in horror, and, you know, also in African-American horror. So, you know, you've seen a lot of things come out since then because of that. But that is what allowed us to get another shot at Tales from the Hood. The difficult part of it was that the amount of money that we had to do that, you know, these last two iterations are less than the amount of money that we had for the first one. So the first one was $6 million, maybe 18 to 20 in today's money. And for these, we got $3 million, you know, a little over three in today's money, somewhere around five in today's money, which, you know, created a lot of, meant we had to leave out some stories that we would have rather had in the anthology than the follow-ups than the ones that we had. It was quite a journey. Thanks to Get Out, we at least got to do something and kind of bring it back. But not having the resources to do what we probably would have liked to do did sting.
Are you able to share any details on some of the stories that didn't make the cut due to budget?
Yes, there's stories that didn't make the cut due to budget, stories that didn't make the cut due to politics, quite frankly. Oh. And, you know, which is kind of understandable, because Tales is a film that really deals with the political and social worlds to some people's delight and to some people's hatred. There are a lot of horror fans, as I'm sure you know, that do not like politics included in their horror whatsoever. So that given. But there's an example of a story, a couple of stories that, you know, we would have liked to have done. There was one that was set at a university and kind of dealt with a little bit of the Dylann Roof story. That was the kid that came in, shot up all the people in the church. What was that, 5 or 6 years ago now? I can't remember. But that story, everyone liked it, and we kept trying to shoehorn it in. But because it was taking place on this university campus, the number of students that we had, there were some party scenes, some fraternity scenes, and so on and so forth, we just couldn't figure out a way to do it. Plus, we were shooting in Canada on the second one. The first one, we were in Louisiana. In Louisiana, the budget was so low that it was a non-starter to begin with. When we went to Canada, we thought we might be able to stretch it. It was still tight. And on top of that, we were shooting in Canada. And I think we shot that in... where did we shoot that? It'll come to me in a second. But we would not have been able to get the extras that we needed. I mean, we obviously needed some white extras, but we needed a lot of black extras that sounded like they were from the United States. And that just didn't present itself too well up there. And then in the second one, the one where we had Keith David, as our Mr. Sims, we shot a whole wraparound, you know, so the interstitial that kind of, you know, holds all the stories together in the anthology, we shot an entire wraparound with Keith and, you know, some of the other actors. And we, I think we shot, that was one of the first things I shot when I got down to Louisiana. And we, you know, put an assembly edit together real quick, and the studio gets it and says, we're not going to release this. You have to rewrite it and reshoot. And we're all like, why? It's like, well, it's obvious you're making too many allusions to Trump, and they were worried about us taking the piss out of Trump. I just worked with an Australian DP, so I'm using Australian terminology for some reason. But I had to rewrite that story, and what we shot in, I think, about 2.5 to 3 days, I had 1 day to reshoot. Wow. And so that wraparound, which now is all taking place pretty much in one room until we get to the end, is every time I see it, I just kind of and you know, these are the traumas and the things that you go through, you know. Making indie low budget films. I talk to people who work on big films and they go, well, it's all the same. It's just bigger money. I'm like, yeah, but at least it's bigger money.
Yeah. I have heard rumors about there being a series at points in development. Was there any truth to that? And can you speak to, you know, what was going on there?
Yeah. Yeah. We were close. We were close on a deal that would have put it with NBC Universal as a, you know, we had gotten a pilot deal to write it, not to shoot it, but we had a pilot deal to write the scripts for it. And like I said, we have stacks of stories to kind of choose from. And it was the classic thing. The head changed before Spike's deal could be done, because Spike is still our executive producer on these. And when the heads changed, the person that came in is like, no, we don't want to do it. It's literally, you know, literally a choice that the new person in charge over there decided.
Now, does that mean, you know, you're at the end of that development, or is there any hope for the future of a series?
We are always looking for some way to do more with Tales, and we'd love to, you know, get a series, and every now and then it comes back up. So I can't say that's the end, because we're always pushing, but it's been a weird struggle, to be honest. I mean, and the tricky part is, you know, making the deals. We have to make Spike's deal, our deal, and all of that. But fingers crossed that you know, we could do something. You know, when I worked on Creepshow with a couple of years back with Greg Nicotero, it just made me want to do it all the more, because that was so much fun. But anyhow.
Yeah, because Creepshow is a great example of sort of the tone and direction that this could take. And you have a lot of experience in the world of TV. I'm very curious, what is Dave Chappelle like to work with?
Oh, man, Dave is you show up to work and you just don't know what you're going to see. And but you know, it's going to be fun and it's going to be good. That's what working with Dave is.
Yeah,
he was one of the, you know, I always had to have a camera on Dave when I was working with him. So when we would shoot, even if I was doing someone else's coverage, I still kept a camera on Dave, because you just never knew what he was going to say. And it was like, you're always trying to catch lightning in a bottle with him. Mm-hmm. Because you can ask him to do it again, and he's not a jerk. He won't go, I can't do that again, but it'll still be slightly different. So because he's always, you know, his comedic juices are always flowing, and when he kind of goes down into the characters that he was doing, and it was interesting, because I would talk to him from time to time and he'd go, yeah, no, I haven't figured this character out yet. So he really put a lot of thought into what looks like sometimes just lunacy and craziness, but for him, he had his process where he would figure out what this character was about and where it was going. And he was pretty sharp about how he wanted to do those things.
I'm also a big Wanda Sykes fan. I'm curious, you know, what is that set like?
Wanda is, you know what? She is like warmer than you would probably think. That's the best way I could say it. I mean, because you see her, you know, her comedic persona, you know, very, very smart, quick, sharp, cutting, the way her comedy is. But, you know, she's also a genuinely good, warm person. So I think that's probably what I kind of took away from the experience of working with her. And I've worked with her a couple of times now. And I'm always like, oh, yeah, she's really actually kind of nice. She's, you know, sweet may be the wrong way to say it, but she's definitely got a warm side to her that you don't get in her comedy.
You've clearly worked with tons of icons. Would you say Morgan Freeman in 57 Seconds was that sort of one of the like most prestige of the field that you've got to develop with?
Yeah, working with Morgan and Josh and the entire cast, but definitely the two of them on 57 Seconds was, you know, for me, kind of stepping into a different space with the type of actor that I was working with. You know, they're so keyed in to what their characters are, their motivations, that the conversations that you have with them are, you know, you're not directing in the same way. You're kind of watching where it goes. And then maybe you're just doing a little nudge, a little guide this way or that, as opposed to, you know, having to, you know, kind of get into the trenches and help someone understand what their character is doing. So, you know, working with them and finding out that I, you know, we had them in the movie, you know, the initial thing is, oh my God, I'm going to really have to have myself together for this. But at the same time, it allows you to kind of focus on things in a different way because they bring so much to the table. The scene in the plane towards the end where the plane is going down and Franklin is kind of accepting this. And you just see all the stuff play on his face. I was like, well, do you want me to talk you through it? He said, no, I got it. And I just put the camera on him and let it sit. And he just brought it. Whatever was happening up in here was happening there. But you can read it all on his face. And to me, it's like one of my favorite little scenes in the film. It, you know, there's no effects or anything, but it's just this guy really giving you everything and, you know, without words. It's really, really cool to see and watch an actor that can bring it like that.
I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that fans can watch 57 Seconds via like VOD and rental. Do we know anything about the future of how fans can access this film and streaming, or is that all sort of locked up right now?
Yeah, I wish I could tell you that I knew more about it other than the Apple of it all, but I'm assuming at some point you know it'll end up on a DVD on Amazon or something like that, but that's an assumption by me. So. Okay.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, and congrats on the exciting new film. It was really awesome chatting with you today.
Thank you, Josh. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to Development Hell. If you enjoy this podcast, then please do us a major favor of leaving us 5 stars and writing a positive review. It really makes all the difference in the world. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.